What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? Well, it's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help you. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. So to save, visit HealthLock.com today. That's HealthLock.com today.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, forward this message onto everybody. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkobon.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So, hey you two.
Hey,
yes, Joe.
You know how in the past we've done some episodes of this podcast called You Don't See That in Sci-Fi?
I vaguely recall that we did such podcasts.
Well, I think we should do another one today.
Well,
I agree, because that's what we have notes on.
This isn't the
future. You're so perceptive.
This isn't the future of ants?
No. Did we already do ants?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I think I just copied my notes from last time. Don't worry, I'll catch up.
Okay. You Don't See That in Sci-Fi is a little sub-series we do within Forward Thinking, where we take something that you often see in science fiction and say, I don't know if that's what the future is really going to look like.
Yeah.
Or something you rarely see in science fiction, or at least don't see as much as we think you should, and say, well, why don't they have more of that?
Right. It's kind of like looking back at, say, the 1950s and reading the descriptions of what they thought the year 2000 was going to be like, and then thinking, boy, were they off,
yeah.
You know, and then thinking, wait a minute, our current visions of the future when depicted in science fiction films could be just as misguided, right?
And sometimes that can be for really fun purposes, like the fact that explosions are pretty, or Mila Jovovich is pretty, or
so
et cetera,
Mila Jovovich exploding in space makes a noise.
Is that how you pronounce it? Jovovich?
Sure.
Probably not. Oh, goodness.
Oh, no. Let's
keep
it. I
apologize, Mila.
Let's keep it, whatever it is. Mila. Mia, right? No, Mila. I have no idea. Anyway, let's continue.
She'll come up again later in the episode.
In the past, we've talked about stuff like, how come when people speak English 500 or 1,000 years in the future, they sound just like people today.
Because if you didn't have them sound like people today wouldn't be able to understand your science fiction movie, Joe.
That's an excellent point, Jonathan. Okay, well, today we want to talk about consumer technology. So how many pieces of consumer technology do you have within reach right now?
No, don't ask me that question, Joe. It's embarrassing.
Well, it's probably a lot. If you're listening to this podcast, I imagine you're listening to the podcast on a piece of consumer technology, unless it's just wafting through the air.
Or perhaps you had
a
friend listen to it, memorize all the parts, and is now performing that podcast for you.
In which case, call us, because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I want to meet your friend.
Yeah, but I want to ask y'all a question. So when you look into a science fiction movie or science fiction book, how is consumer technology like computers and tablets, handheld devices, phones, things like that? How does it seem in those pieces of media?
Well, first, let's be specific.
Right.
We're talking about kind of that idealistic version of the future, not the post-apocalyptic Mad Max version.
Right. Not where everything's wrecked and burned.
Sure, but there's no real consumer technology in Mad Max. I mean,
more like consumer salvage.
It's consumer salvage.
Okay,
right.
Well, yeah. Fair enough.
In futures wherein there are giant corporations that are hypothetically selling these kinds of things, it's usually so sleek and so, well, I mean, whatever our current definition of the word sleek is, at any rate.
Well, yeah, here's what I'd say. It's typically sleek, fast, responsive, immersive. It can anticipate what you want. It's easy to use. The characters are invariably very comfortable using it.
The user displays are really gorgeous.
Yes.
And it's really complicated.
Like, it's like the technology becomes an extension of the characters, right?
Yeah.
There's never that moment where a character picks up that floating display that doesn't appear to be made of anything, and they're about to zoom in on something, and suddenly they get a blue screen of death. That never happens.
Yeah.
Right? That where you're getting at?
Flash player has crashed.
Yeah, right.
Do you want to continue this application?
Right, you just get a bunch of pop-ups. Like,
right.
Can you imagine Minority Report with just endless pop-ups?
Minority Report is a great one because it's a great example that people often refer to when they're talking about what movies have really good, probably very realistic and interesting depictions of consumer technology in the future. Minority Report is one of the most often cited, and they actually did good research going into that film. They consulted with lots of people in the tech industry.
Well, if you see the interface that Tom Cruise's character interacts with in Minority Report, where he's got his hands up in the air and the displays are all floating around and he can swipe stuff off the screen, I mean, you can see the user interfaces and touchscreen devices that obviously take inspiration from that same basic UI design, right? Whether it was from Minority Report or the information that informed the writers and designers of Minority Report to make sure that it had that feel. It's very much a UI that we're familiar with today. It may not mean that we've got displays floating up everywhere, but that same sort of swiping to get things off of a screen or pinching or moving your fingers apart to zoom in or zoom out. All of that kind of stuff is commonplace now.
Yeah. Another good example would be Star Trek. Now, to us today, if we watch old episodes of Star Trek, a lot of the technology might look extremely dated, but it's still within the universe depicting this kind of very fast, sleek, very easy to use, comfortable. It works all the time.
Unless there's a plot point in which it doesn't work, exactly. Or if you're on the holodeck in which it never works.
Right. There's probably a 70-30 chance that if you're on the holodeck, something's about to go down and the holodeck is going to try and kill you.
Right.
The interesting thing about Star Trek is that, again, like you were saying, unless it's a plot point, the technology just works. Not only does it just work, but if you ever pay really close attention, it doesn't make any sense how well it works, because the actors, when they were not delivering a line, might be staring intently at a panel and then pushing buttons like a crazy person. Like, there'll be like 20 or 30 button presses to do whatever task that person is imagining they are doing at that time. But then when you see a character actually have to do a task, often it'll involve like a single button press, and then you pull up all of the works of Charles Dickens. And you think, why does that panel have a Charles Dickens button?
Yeah.
They went to the Charles Dickens panel.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, when you're Patrick Stewart, you gotta have the complete works of Charles. I mean, I'm sure he has all English literature defined to specific buttons, hot button keys on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Well, he's got to print out a new copy every time he spills tea, Earl Grey, hot on it.
Exactly.
It's just F. Charles Dickens. Yeah.
Right. So
I see one of you also put a note about WALL-E. I thought that was a great example.
Yeah.
Now, obviously not the junkyard of Earth, but this spaceship out in space.
The very Apple-inspired spaceship out there.
Right,
yeah.
where technology has reached a point where it's catering to every single need so that humans are essentially subservient to the technology. Not in a overlord kind of way, but in a...
Yeah,
like
a little bit an overlord kind of way.
But they don't realize that. They have willingly given up that agency.
I think at this point we're debating the plot of WALL-E.
No, but seriously, those characters...
The moral of this podcast, if you don't realize it's tyranny, it's not.
It's
but
excellent.
No, it's... They've given up their agency willingly.
Okay,
not...
They have.
They're not...
And it was terrible for all of them at the end.
I see what
tyranny
you're
is a word that you use when you realize how badly off you are.
Okay.
They
okay.
don't.
I take your point.
It's more like a benevolent dictatorship.
Well, I want to transition to talking about why we think the future of technology might not necessarily look like that, where all pieces of consumer tech are very fast, sleek, sexy, and perfect.
Right.
Where a lot of the frustrations we have with technology today, you might very well continue to see even in the future, far down the line of technological development. So one of the first things I think we should talk about is this concept in computing performance known as Page's Law.
Right, and Page's Law is kind of an inverse of Moore's Law. Moore's Law being the idea that that the number of transistors that engineers can cram onto an integrated circuit is going to double at a steady rate, like every year and a half or so.
Right, and by now we kind of suggest that means the processing power itself doubles at that rate, because it may not be an actual doubling of the transistors every 18 months these days, but engineers are finding better and better ways to create architecture so that the processing power in effect doubles every 18 months or so.
The practical effect being that your computer hardware, your new computer hardware is faster every 18 months.
Yes.
Twice as fast as the
hardware that existed 18 months previously. Yes.
Of course, the user experience is not determined solely by what the hardware can do, because the hardware has to run software.
Oh,
yeah.
That's where they get you.
Exactly. That is where they get you. So at a Google developer conference in San Francisco in 2009, the Google executive Sergey Brin coined the term Page's Law, which is sort of the inverse of Moore's Law. And it's also been referred to as Worth's Law, Worth with an I.
Yeah, Worth's Law actually, the terminology there predates Page's Law. But Page's Law is essentially... a synonym.
It was a popularization for it, and it was kind of a little bit of a joke the way that it was presented at this conference.
Right, yeah. But the idea is every 18 months, software becomes twice as slow.
Yeah.
As your hardware becomes twice as fast, the software you run on it takes twice as long to run.
I assume this was a dig at Larry Page, the co-founder of Google.
I'm sure it was all in good fun.
But
some harmless jest.
This law is obviously kind of a humorous, it's not like a universal law, right? We're not talking about the laws of thermodynamics, just like Moore's Law is not a universal law.
Right. We had a whole other episode about a month or so ago, I believe, wherein we talked about some of the problems that Moore's Law is currently running into with the development of, or with the physical capability
limitations of
transistors as we know them.
Yeah, that's right. Moore's Law is not a law of physics. It's sort of a prediction that has turned out to be very accurate so far.
If even self-fulfilling.
Yeah, perhaps self-fulfilling, right? Because if you set out a sort of goalpost for the industry, they might just work hard enough to go through it.
You don't want to be an engineer working when you realize you cannot meet the goal of making a processor that's twice as powerful within 18 months and say, I was there when Moore's Law ended. You probably don't want to be. You want to be
when I was on
my watch.
Yeah. But I think that we've all had this common experience of software bloat and this happens for a couple reasons.
Sure. Feature creep is one thing. So when computers become more powerful, programmers want to take advantage of that power, and so they cram more and more features into a piece of software. Features in air quotes.
Yeah.
Because they might not even necessarily be things that you really want this program to do. But
sometimes they can be very helpful and or pretty.
Well, and a lot of people, a lot of programmers may be working on software that they have these great ideas for what the software can do. The problem is that the hardware as it exists now, the state of the art hardware that your average consumer is going to have access to, would not be able to support that kind of software. But software development takes a lot of time. Sometimes a cycle to develop a single program may take long enough so that by the time the software is done, there's actually hardware strong enough to use it. Now, to the end user, it just seems like the brand new computer is running whatever new version of the program you have at the same rate that your old computer was running the old version of the program, because in fact, the software was developed to take advantage of all that horsepower.
Or that you might even need to buy a new computer in order to run the software that you really want. Like the number of times that I know when I used to do some PC gaming, frequently things would come out that were just a little bit better than what hardware I had.
Yeah.
And so I had to swap out different bits if I wanted to play whatever it was.
Right, right. You might need to go out and get a new graphics card so that you can run that new version of Half-Life 3. Hey, did you guys hear about Half-Life 3? Me neither, because they haven't announced it yet.
No.
Dis.
Ooh, that's...
Sick burn.
Yeah, I guess.
We called you out, Gabe.
So,
time to deliver.
I have a feeling I'm not the first, and I certainly won't be the last. But related to Page's Law or Worth's Law is, there are a couple of other similar kind of humorous concepts. And again, these were kind of meant as tongue in cheek, a way of explaining human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily relate just to electronics, but it can also relate to that. One of those is Parkinson's Law, which was created by C. Northcote Parkinson, that says that work will expand so as to fill the time available for its completion. So in other words, you could have the exact same task and tell one person that you need to get this done in an hour and tell another person that you have 6 hours to do this. And the amount of work that task is going to take will expand to fill that 6 hour period for that second person, whereas the first person will be able to complete it in an hour. This is just one of those things kind of explaining human behavior, not so much a universal law again. Same sort of thing also can come true in the world of consumer electronics in a way. It's a little bit more of an abstract. There's also the Parkinson's Law of Triviality, which can go into software design. The law of triviality states that if you ever get a group of people together to discuss an important idea, important task, something along those lines, invariably that group of people will spend the most amount of time on the least important aspect of whatever that happens to be. Same sort of thing can happen with software bloat, where you'll see people really focus on things that ultimately may not matter. In fact, it may be something that just a tiny slice of the consumers ever even come into contact with.
Those animations of Clippy are so smooth and wonderful.
That's exactly the what I was thinking in my mind while I was saying that. Meanwhile, the
What's
rest
the
of the software
of
bloats.
Clippy?
It's not bright.
I think Clippy's coming back.
Well,
that's my 2014 prediction.
I'm waiting for like Microsoft Bob 2015. That'll be exciting.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's true that things like Page's Law or Worth's Law, or Parkinson's Laws, these things are not hard and fast rules of reality, but they are observations that we laugh at because they seem to ring very true to us.
Sure.
Like, this is a very accurate way of describing the state of technology today. And so it doesn't necessarily hold that future technology will always follow the path of software bloat, but I can see more reason to believe that it will than reason to believe that it won't.
Well, for
because it's been this way so far, and something would have to change for it to really overcome this.
Well, it's being made by people, right? And these are observations ultimately about people,
right?
Not about the technology. The technology itself is completely separate from this. This is really about our behaviors as a species.
Right. The users and the programmers of
the stuff. I mean, it's not likely to change. Now, well, even if you get to a point where you say, what if we reach a future where machines are making our gadgets for us? Like, we're no longer making them ourselves, but a machine is designing them. Well, someone made that machine. So,
yeah,
you know, it may be that there might be several generations down that pathway where you get to a point where the things that are designed really are perfectly designed for a human being.
To perfectly optimize what they're doing.
Yeah. So that it's a completely natural, seamless integration in our lives to the point where we never have that awkward moment where, you know, something just doesn't make sense to us, or we have that issue with whatever gadget we're trying to make work.
Yeah. So what I'm saying in this point of the conversation is that even if we don't posit, say, the end of Moore's Law or something like that, and we say that computers and devices continue to get more and more powerful, I still think in Minority Report, we should be seeing Tom Cruise getting frustrated with memory problems on his big, swipey, sexy, sleek screens. And there should be things that crash and fail to load.
Right. He should pull up a window, realize, oh, dang it. I was looking at Amazon earlier because I needed new shoes, and this is the Amazon thing. This is totally not that file about that person who is about to commit murder.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, okay, but even let's suppose that the technology is perfect.
Okay.
Will all of us be comfortable with it?
That is a great point. That's sort of the complement to the point we were just talking about, because, yeah, you can look at one of the most easy to use, beautiful pieces of technology ever made, and some people will still have a lot of trouble figuring out how to use it. They're just not comfortable with the new tech.
Uh-huh.
That's sort of a fundamental feature of human nature, is that it's hard to adapt to new things.
Wait, are you talking about old people? Is that what this is going?
No, I am not talking exclusively about...
I'm the oldest person in this room. I'm getting a little sensitive here.
I am not talking... No, it doesn't... In fact, though, I don't know, age may be correlated with this issue. We may talk about that in a minute. But you can be anybody and have trouble adapting to interfaces that you're not used to using.
Okay, that's
fair. I think one thing that we should see more in science fiction is people being less at home with their consumer technology. I can't think of a film that's not satirical in nature, where people are just really flustered and frustrated by not knowing how to work their different interfaces.
Well, I think the reason for that ends up being dramatic rather than anything else.
It's
one of those things that would distract from the story, therefore it's not a component. Whereas we would say, well, it's not really realistic. I mean, your average person would probably have, especially getting something new out of the box, brand new thing, would probably have one of those moments where, you know, you toss the instructions away because, you know, you don't need those.
Sure. But it would have been much more realistic is all I think we're saying, to have Tom Cruise have just one single moment where he went, what's that button?
Yeah.
Well,
how do I hit control alt delete?
That's not where I swiped. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, and the point of all this storytelling may not be to go for realism. I understand that totally. I mean, it might be the same reason you don't see characters going to the bathroom in movies, that it's just not interesting to the dramatic storyline. And as we've talked about in several of these episodes before, I accept that point of view. I just think it's worth pointing out. So let's talk about how people become acclimatized to new technology and how quickly they adopt it and become comfortable with it.
Sure. And okay, part of it may in fact be generational. There has been some research.
Get off my lawn.
There's been some research out of the Pew Center, which does pretty good research about the internet and technology, indicating that tech is changing fast enough these days that it's actually speeding up generational differences, making smaller age demographics comfortable with smaller segments of tech.
Huh.
And there was an interesting paper kind of to this point by one Dr. Larry D. Rosen, published in the National Psychologist in 2004. It was called Understanding the Technological Generation Gap. And it pointed out the time frames of previous technological eras, which I thought was really interesting, like the agricultural era, which lasted for some 3,000 years, or the industrial era, which lasted some 300, or the digital age, or information age, or whatever it is that you want to call it, which has been going on for a mere fraction of that, like 30 to 50 years, but has changed intrinsically the ways that most human people interact with the world. He generally suggests that we're all adapting more rapidly these days, but that as generations grow up experiencing such rapid technological evolution, they're going to be able to adapt ever faster.
What's interesting is that this also kind of plays into the idea of the singularity, this idea that we're having these ages of technology and they are transitioning ever more rapidly.
Yeah.
Now, of course, in the concept of the singularity, you enter an age where change is the definition of that era. There's no consistency from one moment to the next. Whether that ever happens, well, we've done some episodes about it, so we don't need to go into it here.
and other research kind of does disagree with the concept that we're building towards some kind of weird superhuman generation like that. There was a critical review of the literature that was published in the British Journal of Education Technology in 2008 called The Digital Natives Debate, and it indicated that the differences aren't so much generationally informed as they are socioeconomically informed, which, of course, is the money and social structure kind of sides of this. And the authors even went so far as to compare the idea that digital natives, these people who have grown up with tech, being intrinsically different, to a kind of moral panic, like similar to the kind of thinking a couple generations ago that Elvis was going to literally ruin civilization as we knew it with his wiggly pelvis.
Did you know that pelvis rhymes with Elvis?
I did. Greece made pretty good use of that fact,
yes,
if I recall.
I recall that too.
I can definitely see what you're saying there about the moral panic idea that people are very concerned about the digital native generation.
Well, I mean, partially because they're their own children and they don't understand what's going on with them.
Yeah.
Well,
they see like, oh man, my kid knows how to use this technology that I don't know how to use. And it makes me uncomfortable.
Probably means it's bad.
Well, it's also interesting in that there have been plenty of studies that have shown that kids growing up with this technology don't necessarily know how to use it, at least not effectively. They may be able to access the things they want to access very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to making any use of it beyond that scope, the scope in which they have become accustomed, like social changing.
Yeah, well, or to get into Angry Birds or whatever it
is. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Whatever that might be, whether it's to end up going on Call of Duty or to send out a message on whatever social network kids are actually on these days. I don't know if they even do that anymore. Get off my lawn. But I mean, no matter what it is, like when it comes down to using this amazing tool for something along the lines of research, they are not necessarily shown to be more gifted than people who were born before the internet became, you know, a household kind of thing, at least in the United States at any rate. So, for example, when I was in school, it was before the internet was something that was accessible to me. I mean, there were research institutions that were on ARPANET and then the early internet when I was a kid, but I didn't have access to it until I was in college. So I ended up adapting to that, but it turns out that my research skills that I developed over time as I learned them are not, you know, it's not like the kids who were born in that era were suddenly on my same level just by nature of the fact that they were born when it happened. They have to develop those skills too. So that's another thing just to keep in mind is that even if we get into a future, another argument to support why consumer technology is never going to be this incredibly seamless experience, we still have to learn how to use it. Until we get to a point where the technology is learning how to react to us, then there's still going to be a learning curve, which means there's still going to be times when you do have that frustrating moment where you're trying to make the replicator actually make your Earl Grey tea.
Well, a lot can go into those learning curves. It's not just an issue of a particular human's capacity to pick up a thing and understand it. It's also a societal and a infrastructural problem.
Hmm.
And I have a rather lengthy, but I think worthwhile example to talk to you guys about telephones. Okay. It took a long time for them to become truly pervasive within our culture. You know, okay, so these days we dial phone numbers using a numerical keypad or a digital representation of one, more likely.
Mm-hmm.
But those keypads only debuted in the 1960s. Before that, it was all rotary phones, which seem hopelessly outdated these days, but were new as of the 1920s. whereupon phone companies had to hold public demonstrations for an entire decade to explain how these things worked, because before then, operators had handled all of the dialing. You would pick up the phone, talk to an operator and say, hey, connect me to this thing, and they would figure out how to do it. You never had to dial a phone previous to the 1920s.
Actually, like in those old TV shows where they just pick up the phone and say, hey, give me, you know, Ethel.
Yeah. Right, exactly. But even when those non-dial phones debuted back in the 1870s, it took like 40 years before the tech caught on enough that companies could stop publishing really basic telephone instruction manuals. One from circa 1910 recommended that you, and I quote, speak directly into the mouthpiece, keeping mustache out of the opening.
I think that's still a valuable piece of information.
It is, but most of us know that.
It was written specifically for Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay, let's look at this in a more quantitative light, because I know that all of that probably sounds a little bit circumstantial. So in terms of phone adoption by the general populace, in 1877, Bell Telephone Company had 778 telephones in existence. By 1899, 20 years later, they had 1 million telephones. That's 1% of the population of the United States with telephones. By 1929, 30 years later, they had 20 million phones. That's 16% of the population. And okay, some people had telephones other than Bell, but being that they were the biggest players in the phone industry, kind of by far, it's an all right rough idea.
Yeah, they were pretty much a monopoly.
Yeah. By 1955, it was 70% of the population. Then, once we hit the digital age, things sped up kind of considerably. Cellular phones debuted commercially in the early 1980s, and these days, a couple decades later, 91% of United States adults have a cell phone alone, not even counting other types of telephones.
So the adoption of cell phones was much more rapid than the adoption of phones in general.
Very much more rapid. In fact, according to a report put out by the United Nations in 2013, 6 billion of the world's 7 billion people have access to a mobile phone right now. And, you know, you could argue that since people were already familiar with phones in general, it was a really easy switch, or that it's an infrastructure issue, not a personal adoption issue.
Quick, just sort of a tangential question related to this. Did you guys adopt cell phones relatively quickly? Did you hold out for a long time?
I was a kid in the 80s, so it's a slightly different question. But I had one when I first went to college. I never had a real phone in college, a landline. I had a mobile phone.
I specifically remember having a conversation on my college campus with friends who had just recently got a cell phone, which at that time, you know, early cell phones were pretty much, that was the realm of the executive, right? There weren't very many people other than executives who had them in the early days, truck drivers maybe as well.
Or like nerds like Fox Mulder.
Yeah.
He is a real person.
I actually had a college professor who was so enamored with X-Files, he would bring a fake giant plastic cell phone and have conversations with Scully on the phone to give class announcements. What's that, Scully? You wanted to remind me that Martin Luther King Jr. Day is Monday? All right, guys, no class Monday. That was really wild. He was awesome. He was my medieval lit professor.
All right.
But anyway, no, I remember distinctly having the conversation at that time saying, I'm not going to get one of those because I can't imagine ever being in a situation where someone needs to get a hold of me so badly that I have to have the phone on my person. That's what answering machines are for. This was in the realm of answering machines, y'all. We're not talking about digital voice recordings. So, of course, now I've got a smartphone and it would be really hard to separate me from it. So
how much message time could your wax cylinder record?
It depends. If the person was not terribly loquacious, I could get maybe 2 messages out of one.
Okay.
But mom, it was like a roll and a half, which is unfortunate if someone was not there to actually switch them out. At any rate, so that's also interesting. I would be really curious to see what the smartphone numbers are as well. I bet smartphone adoption is even faster than cell phone was.
Right, you would be. So regarding people's level of comfort with existing and cutting-edge technology, it may be that both development and adoption are not just speedy recently, but continuously speeding up. It's getting faster still. In a 2012 article for the MIT Tech Review, Michael DeGusta noted that recent technologies like smartphones and tablets might be spreading faster than any technology in human history, though he explicitly notes that it's difficult to compare all historical technological trends as well as global data about adoption rates. Nevertheless, it seems a really distinct probability that these things are true. So older technology like grid electricity and landline telephones, which you talked about taking a long time to reach saturation, might have taken longer to reach maturity because they required infrastructure development. Cell phones and smartphones required less, especially on the part of the consumer, and tablets required even less than that. So with smartphones, for the years throughout the 2000s, the technology dawdled sort of at fairly low adoption rates. You had some BlackBerries and stuff like that. It was really when Apple released the iPhone in 2007 that the smartphone market really took off. Apparently it sold 1.12 million in its first quarter, and that was despite having a high price, DeGusta notes. But it increased its market share very quickly. And so at the time this article was written in May 2012, he noted that 50% of all U.S. mobile phone users, which was 40% of the U.S. population, now had smartphones. And just a little update, as of January 2014, I looked it up, Pew Internet reports that 58% of American adults had a smartphone. That is really, really fast maturity for a new technology.
Yeah.
Now, there were some even faster developments in the tablet world. There were some sort of early trip-ups, early tablets that didn't really go anywhere. Again, it was Apple that made the difference. When Apple launched the iPad in April 2010, it was relatively huge. Within a year and a half, tablets could be found in 11% of American households, and within 2 years, 13% of U.S. consumers owned a tablet. DeGusto noted that that adoption rate was faster than any other technology he could compare it to, and that was, again, in May 2012. What are the more recent numbers? This is astounding. Again, from the Pew Internet Project fact sheet, as of January 2014, 42% of American adults owned a tablet.
What?
That's in 4 years, less than 4 years.
Oof.
That's insane compared to these other technologies that took decades to reach that level of maturity and then eventual saturation in the American markets. And it suggests that we are incorporating more and more newer and newer technology into our lives faster and faster. But it's funny that I feel like there are two different ways you could interpret this relative to our question about people's level of comfort with technology. Does that mean that we're incorporating more and more technology into our lives before we're ready for it, so we're going to be even more and more confused and discombobulated by our devices in the future? Or does it mean something is changing in society where we are getting used to new technology faster than we used to, that our level of comfort with our devices is adapting to become more agreeable, basically, that we just get used to it?
Or that we're more eager to do it and therefore put in more of an effort to learn more quickly.
I think, I think that's a big part of it, Lauren. I think that things like the iPad have really set a precedent where it's increased the interest in consumer technology beyond what it used to be, because it was something that was designed very well, first and foremost. It was a really good design. Secondly, it was marketed really well. So you had an amazing marketing push, an amazing design, and the combination meant that it had a really positive reception in the public. If you had told me 10 years ago that there would be people who would take time off of their jobs, whether officially or not, in order to watch an industry event that Apple is holding, I would have thought you were crazy. But that's what happens now.
Or to camp out outside of an Apple store for a new product release.
Right. That would also, I would have told you were crazy. I would have told my wife she was crazy when she did that for the iPad too. But no, that's the world we live in now. And I think part of that is that this expectation now means that we're eager for that next thing that's going to be like the iPad tablet that will kind of give us that same sort of sense of wonder of what technology can do. And I think there's a lot riding on wearables right now as being the next big form factor for that. And it may be that once someone has got the killer implementation of that, that we see the levels of adoption that are similar to what we're seeing in these other examples.
Yeah, so I think this example might be an interesting thing that actually runs counter to our thesis that people's relationship to technology in the future should look more awkward. Maybe it shouldn't. I mean, maybe future technology trends will be sort of dominated by this Apple-like approach where it says, look, user experience is first. Things need to be very comfortable and easy to use in your hand.
All right.
Especially before we move on, one more quick point, especially being that the technology of marketing, kind of to your point, Jonathan, is also stepping up pretty quickly, and that we are able to know about new technologies and able to troubleshoot them more easily, hypothetically, if the internet is working at the time, than anyone was before. You know, like people don't have to hear about a new Apple product by going out to a fair in their town and having someone stand up and present something to them about it, and they don't have to read a paper instruction manual. It's all very much at their fingertips.
This app cures broken bones, rheumatitis, syphilitis.
I have heard that in 2015, all Apple marketing will be delivered by Carnival Barkers. So I'm just saying.
I would really like that.
That would be awesome, wouldn't it?
And headaches.
But no, more to your point, Joe, about the assertion that perhaps in the future we've got these pieces of technology that integrate so easily. And that's why I think that adopting technology quickly might be a trend. That does not necessarily mean that that technology is going to give us this seamless experience. And so, I mean, I think there'd be even people who would easily argue that the iPad and iPhone are not completely free of issues that are frustrating.
Oh, no, I have had issues with Apple products before. I mean, I'd say I've had fewer issues with Apple products than with the non-Apple products that I know and love and am supplied with by my workplace.
Well, like, for example, the iPhone 4 is the one I like to cite because that was the one that had a little tiny gap on the lower left side that represented where the antenna was. And there were some people who reported that they were having reception issues with their phones. They were getting really terrible reception, even when they would have another phone on that same provider and it would have great reception. And there were multiple reasons that were guessed about for this. Apple eventually came out and said, you're holding it wrong, saying that if you were holding the phone in such a way that your hand obscured this little section of the phone.
AKA the way basically everyone holds their phone.
Well, certainly anyone who's left-handed would hold it where the left side is against their palm as opposed to their fingers. So for left-handers, we just hold everything wrong. I am a left-hander.
Everything you do is wrong.
I know this. Me and 10% of the population, which I realize is a rough number, but yes.
No, it's just you.
Yeah, no, it's just me. Okay, yeah. That's fair. Get off my lawn. So this is one of those things where, again, this was a user problem with an Apple product. So I imagine that we're going to see this happen in the future where, the issue is that you can't, as a designer, necessarily anticipate all the use cases for the thing that you are making, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if my job is to make the next amazing piece of technology that's going to be your, you know, techno arm bracer that gives you the readouts of everything you need to know that day, and you could just stare at your forearm and you've got all the information you need. I'm doing it based upon what I think is going to be the universal experience. But I can't really know what the universal experience is going to be. It's going to be filtered through my own preferences, even if I'm getting notes from other people. So it's very possible I could come up with a product that for a lot of people just doesn't work.
Popeye could have a real problem with that piece of technology.
He certainly would. But he is what he is. So, I mean, you have that as a poster right there in the development team. Because if you designed for Popeye, you'd have a very limited customer base.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at any rate,
okay, the general usability and adaptability of consumer products is kind of another factor that we wanted to talk about here. In that most movies never portray technology as being annoying.
Yeah.
Well, again, some satirical ones do. Well, but your straightforward sci-fi action drama kind of that thing.
Right. If it's horror movies, then the technology is always going to crap out the moment when you need it most, right? Yeah. That's the trope in horror movies. The trope in science fiction is the technology works until you need it to not work.
Yeah.
Right? So in a world like Minority Report, the technology is just this amazing integrated thing that's part of your life.
Yeah.
Just as any other element of your life would be considered like a defining thing, you would not be able to imagine that world without that technology there.
Though, it is funny how we've got technology very deeply integrated into our lives, our phones and our computers and stuff like that. And these pieces of technology still do extremely annoying things.
I mean,
it is deeply, very much a part of my life that I use my phone all the time. My phone has all kinds of terribly annoying habits.
Well, and there are a lot of issues at play here, right? I mean, it's not just that a single device might do something annoying. It's that we don't have, like in the Star Trek universe, you get the feeling that everything is made
by the same person.
By the same person. Right? Yeah. There's one guy who's making everything that's everybody's using. The phasers, the replicators, everything is integrated. Whereas in reality, you've got all these different companies making different form factors with different user interfaces for stuff that's supposed to do the same thing, right?
Right. Yeah. Tom Cruise never like goes over to a friend's house and goes like, wait, I'm trying to swipe the thing and it's not swiping.
Yeah. Oh, it's because the swipe tech patented that particular user interface. And so this one, because it's not a swipe tech display, you can't swipe. You have to blink three times.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing is that when you're able to patent a process, which you can do in the United States, then you can apply that to your technology and then limit what other companies can do. So they either have to license that from you or they have to figure out a different way around it, which means there's no universality to a user interface or form factor.
Right.
You've got a lot of fractured landscape going on, is what I'm trying to say. Like,
right. And furthermore, like your Star Trek communicator works with all of the computers in Star
Trek
because it just does.
Right. Whereas if, you know, we've talked about this with the Internet of Things, if you wanted to have that integrated experience right now with like all the kitchen appliances that can talk to each other, you have to get them all from the same vendor.
Or you'd need a industry-wide kitchen protocol.
Right. So that's one of the reasons why technology is frustrating, is because we don't have a universal standard that each form factor has to adhere to. And we don't really want to have that, because then you're stuck with whatever has been produced, right? You don't have any choice in the matter. Whereas with choice, you've got competition, which at least in theory means the consumer gets the benefit, because the consumer can pick between whichever form factors and user interfaces appeals to that person the most. So there's a trade-off here, right? You have the great advantage of choice, but the disadvantage of the fact that the thing you have may not work the way the thing someone else has. And when you try to get the two to interact, it may not be a smooth experience, unlike the world of the sci-fi, where everything works together all the time until some catastrophe happens.
Yeah. There's also, I think, a thing that bears mentioning, which is the gap between the expectations of what technology can do and what it actually does, which we've experienced many times in our lives throughout the years. I don't know if you'd necessarily expect to see this so much in sci-fi, because it would have to cover sort of the marketing and the media approach to something, and then you'd see how it falls flat. You wouldn't necessarily expect to see that in every story, but it is a very funny feature of consumer tech that I feel like you don't see in sci-fi all that often.
Yeah.
The virtual reality problem.
Right. The idea that you've heard about this technology for long enough, and by the time you're able to actually experience it firsthand, you realize that the reality and the hype don't measure up. So virtual reality in the 1990s is the perfect example. I remember the first time I ever got to put on one of those helmets and play that pterodactyl game.
And you were like,
I was thinking like, well, it's really cool that I can look around and my motions in the real world are being translated into the virtual world, but
I just vomited five times.
Mostly I'm just nauseated.
The latency was certainly an issue in those early days. What was interesting was that you could definitely get the feeling of a virtual presence. Like, you could feel like when you walk over toward an edge in the game that you were near a physical edge, even though you were just standing on the ground. That was interesting. But the actual sophistication was lacking. And so there was this big gap between what we expected and what was delivered at the time.
I played a virtual reality game at a festival one time in the 90s, and I remember, you know, when I was a kid, like, every movie I went to see in the theater was the best movie I'd ever seen. And so I was very easily satisfied, I guess. But I do remember, after this experience, having this feeling like something wasn't right about that.
Well, and of course, there are other examples. Like, the one I wrote down here was Siri and voice controls in general, the idea of having this voice-activated personal assistant.
And the kind of backlash after it came out, where people were like, this Siri thing is kind of dumb.
Yeah. Like, at first, people were thinking, this is really cool, and they were having a lot of fun with the stuff that, kind of the Easter eggs that were hidden with
right.
Siri.
Right. Siri was mostly fun to get cheeky with.
Yeah, it was a diversion more than an actual useful tool.
Siri, where can I do something illegal?
Right. You know? Where can I hide a body? That kind of thing. And then also I had the Windows Surface tablet, which was really being pushed as the next, like a really viable competitor to Apple's iPad. And there were a lot of people who were legitimately hoping that this would happen, because competition, again, is a good thing. Competition pushes companies to keep innovating and to improve their products. So even if you never planned on getting a Windows Surface tablet, you might have hoped that it was a really good tablet, because that would mean Apple would have to come back, and for the iPad 17, it would have to be truly amazing, that kind of thing. And they would continuously push each other. But the general reception of the Windows Surface tablet was that they just didn't quite It just didn't have the magic that it needed to have to really be a competitor of the iPad.
Yeah.
So, again, another expectation versus reality problem.
Cool. Well, I think we should round this up, end by giving a salute to a few sci-fi visions that really do capture the awkwardness of consumer technology in a very perceptive and funny way.
Sure.
As we've said throughout, I think a lot of the sci-fi that does this best is satirical.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I've been trying to think of a serious sci-fi movie that or book or whatever that does this, and I haven't thought of one yet, though I'm sure they exist.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got several satirical ones here. One, which I don't know which of you noted, but I think it's a great one, Brazil.
Right. And Brazil, I wrote that one down, but Brazil really also goes back into that Parkinson's law as well. Because it's not just about kind of a weird science fiction Big Brother state world, which it is.
Yeah.
It's a Big Brother state world that's not efficient at all. It's rampant with bureaucracy.
Right. We should say it's a Terry Gilliam film.
Yes. Terry Gilliam film, and it, you know,
it brings that Terry Gilliam sensibility. There's a lot of absurdity and things are just useless and pointless and don't make any sense.
Right.
But they wield power.
Right. Yeah. if it's a rule, you have to follow it. That sort of thing. Like, the rule doesn't have to make sense, but the rule has to be followed.
And there's a possibility that no one knows why that rule is in place at all.
Right. Yeah. That rule may have outlived its usefulness, but because it's a rule, it's going to be there.
So that describes the government and the bureaucracy in the movie, but the technology is an extension of that same principle. There's all this technology that doesn't appear to have any real purpose.
Most of it doesn't work.
Yeah, hilarious machines that are these giant machines with these tiny little screens on them.
Yeah, and it looks like a kind of a retro version of the future too. There's a lot of old fashioned typewriters that are worked into it. You know, it's a mixture of old tech and high tech sensibilities, and also a level of the grotesque. There's quite a bit of the grotesque, like the facelift device that is pretty memorable in a couple of scenes.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this is the sort of stuff that you look at it and it's definitely pointing out the kind of absurdities of technology that we often encounter.
Another one is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yep. I wrote that one down too. This one also has a lot. Like, this is a universe that you could totally imagine existing, right?
Right.
It's an absurd comedic universe created by Douglas Adams. And in this world, there's plenty of technology that works sometimes despite itself. So, for example, there's a device that Arthur Dent, who is formerly a resident of England.
Contemporary, like 1980s to 2000s England, depending on when exactly.
Yeah.
Which version you're watching or consuming.
So if you're consuming the original version, 1980s, early 1980s era England, he was a resident there. And England, spoiler alert in the in the story doesn't exist anymore because the Earth was blown up.
Sorry.
But Arthur...
It happens on like the third page.
Yeah. Arthur is obsessed with getting a nice cup of tea because he's a real...
He's British.
He's extremely British. And so a cup of tea is sort of his way of dealing with the world ending. Like he's got some stress to deal with. And he encounters a device that, in the words of Douglas Adams, is something along the lines, it's able to produce something that is almost but not quite entirely unlike tea. So it's almost the opposite of whatever tea is, but not quite. It's just on the side of tea enough for it to be identifiable as being almost completely wrong.
Mm-hmm. The automatic doors in this universe, before they will let you into or out of themselves, need to talk to you for a while about their feelings, yeah, about opening.
They thank you for walking through them every single time. This is specifically on
That's a feature, Jonathan.
It's on the Heart of Gold. Feature. The Heart of Gold spaceship. Yeah, no, and then you've got Marvin. Marvin the paranoid android. I mean, you've got...
Is this what we really want when we say we want general artificial intelligence?
Do we want to be able to
really simulate the human mind?
To program manic depression into a robot. Actually, I guess it's not even manic depression. It's just depression.
Regular old depression. Yeah.
He has a brain the size of the planet, and he's standing on the car park for 1,000 years. It's another one of those examples where the technology is another element of absurdity on top of an already absurd story. But it really does point out that in this version, in this world, this universe that Arthur Dent goes through, the things we've talked about with consumer tech and the pitfalls associated with it, at least in this particular book, are universal. They're not limited to the human experience.
Because everyone's ridiculous. Sure. I guess another example of that would be The Fifth Element.
Yeah, I wrote this one down. I filled out this one. I was thinking about it, I was trying to think of science fiction movies where the technology at some point or another just is giving people problems. And The Fifth Element has a couple of moments like that. Particularly, there's a moment where Bruce Willis's character, there's a knock at the door, a doorbell rings, and he goes to answer the door. And there's a would-be robber at the door who's holding a gun pointing at Bruce Willis's character. And he's really twitchy robber guy. And Bruce Willis's character just very casually reaches over and says, you've got the safety on, and turns the safety off for the robber, who just kind of is like, and then Bruce Willis pulls his own gun on the robber. He's like, why don't you just hand that over here? And the guy's like, okay. But it's one of those moments where like the technology is not, you would imagine that in a future world, everything that is designed to do something is supposed to do it really, really well. Especially weapons in some cases, especially in the world of The Fifth Element, which is pretty violent. The technology in The Fifth Element ranges from really useful to unreliable. So it seems pretty realistic. And also the vision of the future in that is not the pristine, glorious, glimmering future that you see in a lot of other, far-thinking science fiction films.
Yeah, though that one I would also say, though, I wouldn't strictly call it a satire. It is does have strong humorous undercurrents.
I'd say it's
a
comedy adventure with an emphasis on the comedy.
Yeah. You can't have the characters in that movie and not call it a comedy.
Weird straight future RuPaul is certainly a thing that happens. And it's that one in particular I find pretty interesting because it's again a very cobbled together version of the future that incorporates a lot of historical technology and historical looking technology, and different characters from different social strata have access to different types of technology.
Right,
and there's a little bit of a discussion about the economics of all of that.
There's a lot of different cultures represented, including alien cultures, as it turns out, which is really interesting that you see this kind of mishmash world. And there is still like a social structure, like you were saying. It kind of falls in that the lower in the world you are, the lower floor you live on, essentially.
Right.
It's kind of a direct correlative there.
So what do y'all think? I mean, have we been too hard? Maybe these movies have some good reasons for making all the future technology, the consumer technology, look sleek, sexy, fast, easy to use, perfect? Or should they make an effort maybe to show more of the foibles of the consumer electronics?
I think if it's not distracting, then it's perfectly fine to throw in a couple of little moments if that's not even the point of the movie. Like even let's say you've got a plot of a movie where technology is part of the setting, but it's not the focal point. So it's not like the technology has risen up against the humans.
Right.
But I think it's still fine to have, like, even if it's just a background thing where you see someone who's clearly struggling with something, I think that could be a moment where you think, oh yeah, I guess in the future we'll still be human.
Yeah, yeah, it's a very humanizing moment. Yeah, yeah, and I think it's a great potential for levity, which I personally enjoy very much, even in very, very action, blow stuff up, all the serious things kind of movies, and especially in those, really, I think it's a terrific little salt to the dish. Kind of negatively, in terms of what's actually going to happen in the future, and this is kind of a cynical outlook, I suspect that this is going to be a social strata economic kind of issue, wherein the upper classes are going to have perhaps the more sleek, more wonderful technology, and that there might be more of a divide, unfortunately, between the haves and have-nots in this sort of discussion.
Yeah, when you
that
talk about
be the case, I mean, it
is
to
consumer
some extent,
technology.
To
so.
Some extent, it is very much like that today. And so I guess the question is, will it get better? I mean,
maybe.
I hope.
We definitely want that future, right?
Yes.
We want the future where people have
affordable access to that kind of thing.
I mean, if we ever hit the Star Trek future, then money doesn't matter anymore and everybody has access to everything, which would be nice.
Also jumpsuits.
Also
never
jumpsuits.
Never forget the jumpsuits.
Yeah. So I guess that wraps up this discussion. If you guys have any suggestions for things we never see in science fiction that you want us to cover, maybe you think, hey, you know what we never see anymore? Ruby Rod. Can we see more Ruby Rod in science fiction? Let us know. Send us a message on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. Our handle is FWThinking, and you don't have to limit it to just that. It could be any topic you want to hear us cover about the future. Drop us a line, let us know, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.